Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in to Drive Through HR. We are live on air at this moment, and we are thanking everyone for joining with us today. At Drive Through HR, it's a special day for us because, you know what, we have been waiting for this particular show for a month. So it's a big day for us. So, William Tinkup, Michael Vanterwart, Crystal Miller, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about human resources. But today, there is something special because we are talking to a legend, Dave Ulrich, professor at the Ross School of Business, University of Michigan, partner at the RBL Group, and executive director of the RBL Institute. So we can't wait to, you know, talk to him. But before we get to that, if you are listening to the show and if you would like to ask any questions, hit the hashtag DTHR and we will be live on air for this next 60 minutes. So it's a one-hour show. It's a special show. Enough of it all, if you would like to ask any question, hit the hashtag DTHR and we will be able to pull that up. So without further ado, let us welcome Mr. Dave Ulrich. Hey, sir, welcome to Drive Through HR.
Thank you, Nisha and Crystal. I'm honored to be a part of your show.
Thank you so much. So I'm sure I might have missed something to introduce to our audience. So why don't you talk a little bit more about, you know, who you are so we can better connect with you and find out a little more about you, right? Something personal.
Super. Let me... In three ways. Technically, I'm a professor at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. I've been there for a lot of years, probably more years than either of you are old, and teach exclusively now in our executive programs, our advanced human resource executive programs. Professionally, I'm passionate about learning. And I described once to a group of colleagues that elephants eat grass. They process grass, and they pass grass. I want to be the one that plants the grass they eat. And what that means is I want to learn about what's next. And so what that leads me to doing is analytical research. My background is in statistics and taxonomy, mathematics, more or less. But I really want to look at what's next and try to define what some of the folks today call the mysteries of HR. For example, we just did, a great book called The Rise of HR, sponsored by HRCI, where we asked 70 or so thought leaders, what's happening in the HR space? What's next? How does HR add value? Got great insights, not heavy empirical, but wonderful insights. And I'm passionate about that kind of learning and insights. So, one, I'm a professor. That's my role. I do consulting. I have a consulting firm, too. My passion is to learn about where and how HR adds value in the future. And then three, more personally, probably the thing I just did a brief essay of what I'm most grateful for. And the things I'm most grateful for, obviously, as most people, start with my family. I've been in a relationship with my wife for 40 years. We have some wonderful children. We have 6.55 grandchildren, which means two are on their way. I'm not always a great husband, father, or grandfather, because I sometimes get lost in my ideas, but it's just delightful to see that the kingdom and impact we ultimately have is probably with those we care about the most. So I do that. That's, if you want to know more, I'm pretty transparent. If you meet me, I obviously eat too much and talk too much. So that's a little bit about me.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. And I don't think I've heard anyone say that out loud. Sorry, I just tripped all over myself. This is Crystal. I don't think I've really ever heard anyone say that, you know, it's neat to see that the impact that we make the most is with our family. When we're talking about careers, typically they tend to focus on careers. So I love that you brought in that element of your life. Thanks, Dave.
No problem.
Well, let's start at the beginning. How did you get into HR? I know there's a fair number of people that I've talked to about you coming onto the show who've wanted to know. What's his HR experience?
It's an interesting journey, and I'll go back. Let's start at the beginning. I was born of goodly parents. No, I, I wanted my whole life as a young man to go to law school for some reason. And the law school world interested me and solving the law problems. So I'm in college studying and planning to go to law school. A friend of mine said, you know, you should take this course called Organizational Behavior. Why? And he said, it's a great course. And I knew him and I trusted him. I took a course from a professor who literally captivated me. His name is Bonner Ritchie, one of the legend professors in this field. For example, he said, we have no papers due. Look at the world around you and see how organizations affect what you know and do. And I started looking. I was majoring in English at the time, so I started writing papers about the first one I think I wrote was called Beowulf, The Ideal Organization Man. Now, I cheated. I turned it into my English professor. I turned it into my English professor. I turned it into Bonner because he had, you know, show me what you've learned. And the English professor said, this is a weird assessment of Beowulf. And Bonner said, this is cool. Do another one. Net, net. In Bonner's class, I wrote 15-page papers every week. I just got captivated by organizations. And at the end of that, he sat me down. He said, what are you planning to do with your career? And I said, I want to go to law school. He said, what a waste. No offense to attorneys. You've got to come in and take another class. Anyway, with his gentle guidance, he just turned 80. I called my mom and dad and said, I'm not going to go to law school. I'm going to study OB. And they were pretty happy. They thought OB was obstetrics. not obstetrics, it's organizational behavior. They didn't know what it was, and I frankly didn't know either. So I ended up studying and ended up going to UCLA to do a PhD and started really trying to figure out organizations. And then when I went to had the privilege of doing research at UCLA on what makes organizations, I ended up at Michigan and did a lot of application. I enjoyed today I would call it Ideas with Impact. That was the book we wrote on learning. And that led me to HR. Where in organizations do ideas around organization, people, culture, leadership, these interesting ideas that captivated me then and today, where do they show up? And it was through human resources. And so
very
that
cool.
got me into the human resource field. So that's more than you wanted to know, but that's the agenda that got me there.
Okay. So, you know, you ask kind of an easy leading question. I think one of the rules of journalism requires that I hit with a harder question. So say this with love. There, you have probably a fair number of detractors on this particular model. I don't know if it outnumbers the number of people that love it. But let's talk about your tiered services model for a little bit. Because just part of me wants to understand, why would you take the best and brightest HR minds out of the front lines where employees can see them? Instead, it's almost like the call center model of your least experienced HR professionals are the ones that are interfacing the most with your employee population, and it seems like that could be problematic. So could you walk
us
through
that?
You
know, I love
you're
asking the question. I love you're asking the question because it's a misinformed question completely. The purpose of any HR organization is not to get an organization right, it's to deliver value to the company. And instead of debating how do we build an HR organization, we should be debating how do we add value to the company and how does HR organize to do that. And so one of the things we've learned is that HR work, just like technology work, marketing work, finance work, is different. That some of HR work is administrative, payroll administration, benefits administration. Those transaction pieces of HR, what my colleague calls foundation pieces, they have to be done. That's a critical part. But increasingly, they're being done through technology. And technology leads you to a service center. And so creating a service center is kind of like IT building data centers. It's like finance building accounting centers. You don't need lots of people to do that. And that administrative work of HR has to be done seamlessly. It has to be done flawlessly. And it allows people to do their work well. And it's not just in HR. I had to ask, Nisha or Krista, when's the last time you were in a bank?
Last week, and it drove me nuts.
Okay. how do you generally do your banking?
If I can do it online, I do.
No question. That's HR. I mean, it drives me nuts to have to go through the administrative work and go through it in a face-to-face transaction that's not necessary. Now, sometimes it is. By the way, some people still like to go to a bank. They like to go in. They like to see the teller. They like to build the relationship. But most of us do our banking automated. That's what HR
does. Well, and that's okay, so that's where I was going to go with that. So, thank you. Part of me does want to go into the bank at times for a number of reasons. One, I get really frustrated by the constraints of the automated system that doesn't understand context or circumstance. It's just, this is what is. And, you know, if I'm depositing a check, that's fine until my check is $2,501 and I can't automatically deposit a check with using my phone if it's over $2,500. That's dumb. But it's the way the system's set up because computers can't apply anything other than just logic rules, right? There's no thought. There's no figuring anything out. And when it comes to things like benefits issues or payroll, your deductions need to be changed. If it's as simple as filling out a form, that's fine. But I don't know about you, but in my HR experience, when I was dealing with all of this, man, half my day got sucked up with answering questions about how much should I be taking out? And questions that really HR shouldn't be asking or answering, but they get asked anyway. So how do you, I mean, your frontline people aren't going to know that.
And I would hope that a good HRIS system, well, first of all, it sounds to me like you have a lousy bank. If your bank has got limits that don't work for you, then your bank is not doing a good job. So it sounds like maybe we should give you some coaching on finding a bank that services you better. I bet you're going to get 5 or 6 emails from financial institutions who say, this is dumb. I mean, banking rules are designed to manage efficiency and to give value to their clients. And it's the same in HR, that if somebody has a question, they should have access to that. And there's no question. So some of Service Center is technology and some of it is the call center. And in the call center, those things that aren't done on technology get done through a call center. Now, I would come back at you and say, okay, here's the other option. We have a person for all of those standard routine questions that are mostly routine and standard that can be done in a call center. That increases cost. Would you be comfortable with that?
Perhaps. I mean, to a limit, right? It's all balanced value against cost.
Well, that's the balance issue. And what I've argued, and it's why it's fascinating to hear your comments, there are some people, and you may be one of them, who do want to go to a bank. They want to have face-to-face interaction, and they want that personal contact, even on the routine transactions.
But
I have to confess, my mom is
right?
one of them. My mom is one of them. My mom is one of them. She likes to go to the bank. She likes to see the teller and to have the transaction.
But it's not the experience that people like, though, Dave. What they like is the fact that there's a relationship there that allows them to manipulate a system, right? So I don't really care about now I'm going to sound awful. I don't really care about the teller per se. I care about the fact that over time the teller gets to know me. And so when I need something, I have enough of a equity built up into that relationship to ask for it.
And a good HR shared services organization will do exactly that. You have a call center. And by the way, call centers aren't unique to HR. I mean, what you're going after is the whole logic of call centers. When I buy something from Banana Republic, we have our insurance with USAA. They're phenomenal, and it's mostly through call centers. And a good call center, managed well, builds a relationship with you. When we call USAA for an insurance problem, they're phenomenal because they have a data set about our history, and whoever answers the phone may have worked with us before, so we get some continuity. And we don't have the cost and the burden that makes it inefficient. Good HR systems are designed to manage both efficiency and relationships. And if you're experiencing that's not happening, that means you probably need to get a better system. Because, and it's the same, it's true, when I order from Amazon, I have, through the system, I can do it. But if I need to talk to somebody, call centers are wonderful ways to begin to make some of that happen. Now, you can do it badly. I mean, any organization run badly is not going to be effective. I can hire bad tellers in a bank if we want to continue that metaphor, or I can have a bad HR or I can have a bad technology system. But the idea of saying we're going to have dedicated face-to-face HR people for every HR question, to be really honest, that's a little naive. I mean, I think that went away 20 years ago. Call centers exist in almost every part of my life. When I make a hotel reservation, when I make a car reservation, when I make an airline reservation, the call centers enable me to do what I need to do in a way that works for me. And now if there are special needs in an airline reservation, I can get an agent, I can get a reservationist who can look up my account because I'm a frequent flyer and give me that tailored service. That's what a good call center does. So I'm trying to figure out what the option is. I mean, the other option is going back to personal contact in every setting. And I think every employee in an organization should be able to access an HR person. That's why we have embedded HR people. We have basically four pillars of an HR model. We have the service center that allows me to do the HR transaction work around pension, benefits, relocation in a way that's efficient and easy for me. I do banking Sunday morning. We have centers of expertise who have deep knowledge and expertise that will bring to the company the best insights that we've got. And we've got embedded HR people. And if I'm an employee and I have a question that the call center can't easily answer, a good call center will refer me to my embedded HR person and say, talk to Sally, talk to Harry. They have a question. Let me get them on the phone so that your unique question can get an answer. And so I'm really trying to struggle with what the option is. And so when people say the model doesn't work, I go, you really got three choices in HR. One is to have an absolutely centralized HR model. Two is to have a heavily decentralized model. And third is to have this kind of hybrid model that I've described. And so I'd love for you to say, which one would you do? The very decentralized model, which you're implying, puts an HR person, you'll have your HR ratio maybe 1 to 40 or 1 to 50, and it adds cost. I mean, the company adds cost and in general doesn't get much more value out of the additional cost. So we're trying to find a way to do that.
Well, the cost is there either way, right? Like, so the cost is there either way. It's just, do you get two cheap people or one moderately priced person or half of an expensive person? Like, it's to me, and I'm oversimplifying, and I'm not a math major, I'll be the first one to say that, but it doesn't seem to me like you're saving a ton of money if your answer to this is to get four people with relatively no experience in HR and put them in your front line to field questions, because let's face it, they're going to create more questions.
You're creating I've got it. You're creating a straw man that just doesn't exist in most companies. I mean, you don't get four incompetent people. Call center people have great expertise, and they're able to answer the questions. Now, I mean, if you want to create a straw man that doesn't work, if you want to create a straw man where HR doesn't work, I give it to you. I can go find him as well. But I think you're creating a false straw man. I mean, guess what? We hire an HR reporter who's really incompetent and can't report well. Well, they don't write good articles. What's wrong with the system? It's not the system. You got to get good people in the system. And so it's curious. I would assume then you wouldn't buy anything much from Amazon. You would go to bookstores to do your purchasing.
I don't, actually. I do go to bookstores. I like them. I'm that girl.
Yep. I mean, my view is there's 20%, I don't know if it's that number, who still like to go to banks. I like bookstores also, but I still buy a lot from Amazon. And there's a percent of folks that is true. Now,
You have to balance the credibility, Dave. I get where you're going with it, and you're right. Like, you're right. You have to be able to create a scalable model that relies somewhat on technology, that allows for non-strategic, tactical questions to be handled with lower-level personnel. Like, you do. I get it. But at what point do you sacrifice?
No, you're still creating a straw man. Time out. I mean, you start this call by attacking my model, so I'm gonna come back at you pretty strong.
I'm attack you.
No, you you say we want to do a call with you, and then you begin by attacking what I do, and that's not what I expected, but that's fine. I'm very open to alternatives, but to say these are low paid people who are incompetent, I think you've just demeaned an entire industry called call centers. Call center people don't have to be incompetent, low salary people. Call center people can be very technically excellent at the things that they do and deliver. I think at Nationwide, the people we work with in that insurance industry are excellent at what we do. And we've had fantastic, their net promoter scores are some of the highest in the world because the call center people, now you're creating a straw man, call center people by definition are stupid. I don't go there. I think you can get call center people who are exceptional.
I didn't say that. I talked about experience, not intelligence.
Well, and call center people can be experienced. I mean, if I call a call center, I expect the person in the other line, no matter in banking, in airlines, to be able to respond to the needs that I've got. And I see that. I do most of
That's
my airline
fair.
Reservations through a call center at Delta. They're some of them are long-term. Some of them have been there 20 years. And so when you create a straw man that says, gee, this is, doesn't work because the people aren't very good, that's fine. I mean, that's true. And in some cases that happens, but that doesn't mean the idea is wrong.
Okay,
well,
fair.
Dave and Crystal, I want to switch the gear a little bit, if you will. So we were talking about competencies a lot, and we would like to get your perspective on your latest book, that is HR From Outside In. So, you know, do you think the HR should cope with both ends of each time machine, let's say strategic and administrative, or business and people? It should be both outside and inside, right? So what's happening, for me, what's happening inside is equally important as what's happening outside too. So why don't you tell our audience why HR From Outside In?
I'm not sure we're done with the other discussion yet. Let me go back. Crystal, are there any other follow-ups? I mean, I'm not afraid of discussion and debate. In fact, I love debate. I love discussion.
Oh,
that's where we learn. So I want to make sure that you're comfortable with where we've left that.
No, I am. I mean, like, I could probably spend hours talking to and trying to understand all of the models with you, and I know that there are a lot of topics that we want to cover. To some extent, I'm taking a contrarian viewpoint. I do like the model. I do see that there is a little bit of a roll of the dice with it, though. I mean, you do have some... To take your airline experience, I do the exact same thing. You know, American has gold, platinum, and executive platinum, and you get different levels of experienced people depending on what your level is, what your rank is within their marketing program. Cool, whatever. But it's a total crapshoot whether or not I'm going to get somebody who can actually take care of my needs. And that, to me, is when you apply that same concept to HR – and you apply that sort of roll of the dice, am I going to get someone who's going to be able to take care of me today? I'm affecting more than just the HR organization if I get someone who can't. I'm affecting the entire business organization because that person is taking away from their ability to get the work done that will ultimately meet the business goals, that will drive the revenue to keep the doors open.
So what would your proposal be?
I'm not going to say I have the answer, so I'm not trying to attack your model and say it's wrong. I'm trying to say it feels like there's some holes to it. How do we fix it? How do we ensure that doesn't happen?
It doesn't work. It's fine. But what would you? I mean, I get it, but I'm trying to see what the option is. I mean, one option is to go back to hiring benefits people and put them in every plant, in every location, and not have a call center and not have a technology-based system.
Could you have functional specialists that deal with case management systems so that they can look at things that can't automatically – I mean, it's not that much different than what you're proposing.
And most companies have that. Most companies will say when you call a call center with a healthcare problem, for example, and it's not within the routine, they will elevate that to somebody. It's like Nationwide Insurance. I mean, what you're going after is the logic of call centers. American has call centers. American, I think, would take umbrage with you that they put incompetent people if you don't have high diamond status.
Totally welcome to take umbrage with me, and my email address is cm@brandedstrategies.com, and I will have that conversation with them all day long. I've got a well-documented history with them.
I mean, it's – and the point is call centers are not perfect, and I'm not going to defend call center logic, but I've got to see the other option. I mean, 30 years ago, the HR people were embedded in the business. They got criticized because we had green eye shades HR people who did benefits. They didn't understand where the business was going. And I think with what we're trying to do in the HR field is manage this incredible set of paradoxes, and I'll get in now to the outside in. I mean, one of the paradoxes is you have to care deeply about the employee. There's no question HR is about the employee and the talent and making sure employees feel engaged and committed. We did a book called The Why of Work on that and the power of employees and engagement. But HR people also have to care about the business because if you simply care about the employee and it doesn't deliver ultimate value to the business, we're going to be a great social organization that doesn't exist. And the paradox that you raise in the administrative part of HR is HR has to do administrative work well. That was the book HR Champions that I wrote about 20 years ago, is that it's not from to. We're not doing HR from administrative to strategic. We have to find a way to do both. that we have to care for the administrative needs of our employees, and we have to help them be strategically relevant for the business. We have to focus inside, and we have and the challenge in any paradox is not overdoing either one. I mean, if we come and say HR is all strategic, it's long-term, it's where we're headed, and we don't care about the day-to-day operation. One of the persons in a workshop said, you know, I come from the benefit side in this service center, and all of you are talking about strategy and HR and the future and talent acquisition and organizational design. None of you are going to get paid next week. Well, that's really stupid. I mean, you got to manage the inherent paradox. And I think that's what I think that's one of the challenges of any business leader, is a business leader has to manage the paradox of the individual and the whole, of the customers, of the employees, of the investors. And I think HR is in the same box.
Well, Dave, we have a question that has come up on our Twitter stream, and that is from India. And his Twitter handle is Ulhas, and he is asking, what functional areas of HR will assume more importance in the next few years to come?
That's a very good question. And I would tweak the question a little bit. I don't know if I should go to that question or if I should go back to your question about outside in. Let me frame the question in a little bit different way. I think we're able to get off the percent of folks who want to continue to go to the banks and go to bookstores. So I often do workshops with HR people. I'm privileged to do it. And I almost always start with the question, what's the biggest challenge in your job today? And here's what almost, not everybody, but over the last 15 or 20 years it's evolved, but people say, my challenge is an HR functional area. I'm trying to hire people. I'm trying to pay people. I'm trying to train people. I'm trying to motivate people. I'm trying to build my credibility within the company. I'm trying to do career planning. One of the things we've learned is that there seems to be an evolution of the challenges of HR. And we have four levels. Level one, the challenge is the administrative work. And I have to get the administrative things done well. Payroll, benefits, the things Crystal talks about. We've got to do those, and we've got to do them well. There are some groups who are saying the standard for good HR is cost per hire per employee. That's an administrative measure of good HR. I think we need to move to the second level, which is functional excellence. And that could be in talent acquisition. It could be in succession planning, career planning. Could be in performance or compensation. Could be in communication. Could be in organization process. We need to build good functional excellence. And when somebody asks the question, which function is going to be improved, I think we have to go to the third level, which is for the last 20 years we've called it strategic HR. Are those functional areas linked to the strategy of a company? And the strategy could be we win or we grow through innovation. So we hire people who have creativity. We hire people who seek new ideas. We could win or grow through cost. So we manage our productivity more aggressively. We get our payroll cost as efficient as we can. Or we win through customer service. We try to manage our customer services as efficiently as we can by how we hire, pay, and train people. And I've been involved, as have many others, in strategic HR. And the metaphor was strategy is a mirror. So to our colleague from India, which of those HR practices is more important would depend on what the strategy is. If the strategy is to grow through innovation and product design, we're going to have to hire more people, perhaps. Or you're going to have to pay more people. Or you're going to have to pay for innovation. I think now there's a fourth wave. Wave one is administrative. Wave two is functional. Wave three is strategic. And I think wave four is outside in. And instead of strategy being a mirror, look at strategy as if it's a window. And say, look through the window of strategy to the outside world. How do we connect HR with what's going on outside? So here's some three or four quick examples. We want to be the employer of choice. That's been a metaphor for HR that's really been a good one for 10 or 15 years. I would now add to it the outside-in criterion. We want to be the employer of choice if employees our customers would choose. We want to do a great job in training and developing our people. From an outside-in perspective, it would be, we want to do a great job developing and training our people so that, and I would put so that behind it, so that our customers get the products or services they expect. We want to do a great job in performance management. It sounds like you've flown a lot on American. One of the things some of the airlines have done is they now give those who fly a lot coupons. So I'm a frequent flyer on Delta. I've got 15 million miles on Delta, and they send me coupons. They are intellectually saying is, Mr. Roberts, because you fly a lot, you're going to control a piece of our bonus pool. And so we give you coupons that represent economic value to the employees. And so when I see a good service, I give that employee the coupon, and I, the customer, am now part of their performance appraisal system. We can take almost every HR practice and link it to the factors outside of a company. For example, the new book, The Rise of HR, was this fascinating book about the future of HR. The book I have coming out in the fall is one that's excited me more than any book in 20 years, and it's called The Leadership Capital Index. An external stakeholder to almost every publicly or privately held firm, publicly traded, are the investors. In privately held firms, those are the ones that provide debt, and publicly traded, those are the stockholders. They are beginning to say part of our evaluation of the quality of firm we invest in is the quality of leadership, but they don't have a way to assess it. And so I've created a leadership capital index. It's like a Moody's index for creditization. Now an investor can say, does this firm have better or worse quality of leadership? And that may affect the debt covenant, the price of money, or it may affect the stock price and the intangible value. That's the direction where I see HR headed. And so to our friend from India, it's not which HR practice area is the most valuable. When you go into a business meeting, I don't think we go into a business meeting talking about an HR practice area. I think we go into a business meeting as good HR people talking about how to help the business win. And if the business is going to win through innovation or through geographic expansion or through cost, we then create the organizational capabilities that help that business win. Anyway, that's a very long answer that tried to answer two questions.
No, that's good.
That's great. Thank you so much. We're going to do a quick reset for anyone who's joining us on Drive Through HR. We are talking with Dave Ulrich, who is pretty much the living legend of the shared services model. So thank you so much for joining us. We do have another question from our Twitter stream. Are you ready for it?
You bet.
Okay, cool. So this one's coming from St. Louis with Dwayne Lay. Doesn't functional excellence have to be looked at through the Kano model? Some functions aren't valuable enough for excellence. And this is one of two. Second tweet, it's only worth pursuing if valuable to employees as customers. So which areas would you say aren't worthy of the full court press?
I don't understand the question. So give me an example if the person's responding. I wish we could do a call-in question. So some functions are valuable to employees but not customers.
Employees are the customer. So if you talk about employees being the customer,
I think that's HR. Okay. I think that's HR 10 years ago. I think in an HR world, if you think your only customer is the employee, you're missing what HR can fully add value. That's why this Rise of HR book is so fun, because the goal of HR is not to get employees happy. It's to get employees happy so that they can create happy customers who help the company survive. This is where I think sometimes in HR we get labeled with a false and sometimes potentially negative brush, that when we define our customers as the employees, that's like marketing or finance saying, I define finance as success as filling out the form. Well, that's not the success of a finance function. The success of a finance function is you make wise investments in capital to help your business win. And it's why I ask that question. I love to ask the question, who are the customers of HR? And employees are clearly a stakeholder, but the customer of HR is the customer of the business. And when we get that headset, it changes the way we think about and do HR.
Well, we have a call-in number who would like to ask a question directly to Dave. So, Crystal, would you recommend to take that call?
Yes, absolutely.
That is, the call is from 706-212-0079.
That's Michael. Hi, Mike Vandervoort. Dave, I'm one of the co-hosts. I'm sorry for being late for your show. I had another call, and so I just dialed in. But thanks so much for being on Drive Through HR.
Hope your call went well.
It was obviously momentous to have skipped this, but I haven't even had a chance to listen in. My My question, Dave, and I know you're actually, I'm from University of Michigan grad from a long time ago, and you and I met at HR Florida several years ago when you spoke down there. I do a lot of labor relations work, and I just wondered, without trying to take the show completely off the rails, if you could comment on kind of like today's atmosphere in labor relations and how that fits into your research and engagement and that kind of
you
stuff.
Bet.
Very broad question.
Well, what would you say? I'm curious, since you've done a lot of work there, probably more than I have. I don't spend quite as much time in labor relations.
So the thesis that I'm with an organization, the thesis that we offer up is, you know, great places to work. Not to steal a theme, but just, you know, by definition, companies that are great employers are less likely to experience, you know, labor relations problems. And so I guess, you know, engagement, happy employees, which I just kind of heard you say as I came on the call, happy employees are more productive and all that. But there are a lot of great companies out there right now that are experiencing issues related to wage equity and, you know, low pay and, you know, just kind of there's sort of a general almost a theme of unrest in some industries, specifically fast food, retail, some of those kind of things. And yet there are great employers out there that are doing very well. And I guess I was just kind of looking for, you know, I mean, I think there's an obvious correlation that the better the company is, the happier the employer, the higher their engagement. But still, even if you're a great employer, some still face issues. And I guess I was just kind of wondering what your thoughts were generally around that.
So you've shifted a little bit from union negotiations and contracts to engagement with employees, which is a great place to go. Mm-hmm. I think there have been three phases in the employee sentiment literature. Phase one is satisfaction or happiness. And frankly, what most people found is that it wasn't highly correlated to a business performance. And so the first question we'd ask in a survey, it used to be, do you like your boss? Do you like your pay? Do you like your working conditions? And that sentiment of happiness or satisfaction didn't work very well. The shift has been more to engagement. Does your boss give you the skills to do your job? The Gallup index or Mercer's index is, it's not, does your boss make you, you know, do you like your boss? But does your boss give you the skills? Does your boss give you the tools? That shift is subtle but significant because it now begins to say that it's not about liking job conditions or work. It's about having the knowledge, skills, and ability to do your work. And in those settings, the employee engagement is correlated with customer engagement and often leads to higher productivity. We're now moving in 3A and 3B. The next direction in that sentiment literature is not, do you like your boss? Does your boss give you skills? But does your boss help you find meaning and purpose? And I like that direction because it really begins to shift. In the Gallup work, they're now moving to well-being. Does your boss and does your organization allow you to have a sense of meaning, a sense of purpose from the work you do? That's what we did the Why at Work on, is when you move to that space and it comes out of a whole bunch of different disciplines, you begin now to get people who are at work, not with behavioral engagement, I show up, I have the tools, but emotional engagement. Now, 3B that Marshall Goldsmith has done a brilliant job with is not does your boss give you meaning, but are you taking the proactive and personal accountability to find meaning at work? The shift that we're seeing around that engagement literature is from satisfaction to behavioral engagement to emotional engagement and then to personal accountability for that emotional engagement. I like that shift because it begins to say work settings should be a place where employees have some autonomy and responsibility and opportunity to find meaning. Now, how does that affect an organization? I think what you just saw with Walmart is a great case, and we can debate it forever. But Walmart just said, we know that wages are a piece of that employee value equation. They just spent $1 billion. I mean, that's an enormous amount of money for any firm to begin to increase some of that employee sentiment to the organization. And it doesn't just like the job. It isn't just getting the skills. It's a job that can provide a better sense of meaning. And the $1 billion is not just wages. It's learning, it's training, it's development kind of opportunities. Now, the thinking behind Walmart is that's not just a social agenda, and it is partly a social agenda. That's the paradox. It's also a business agenda, that if we can get employees in our stores to have a better sentiment, a better sense of well-being, a better sense of purpose at work, our customers will feel that, and we'll be able to get a better revenue per customer that will be successful. And so ideally what you get in instead of paradox and competing demands is a virtuous, not a vicious cycle. That if we can get our employees to feel this sense of well-being, this sense of purpose, why of work, the stuff we did, they will in turn help customers, not all of them, but more of them, feel the same sense, and that will in turn help employees feel like they're contributing value. So that's kind of where it's going. The labor relations issue is a fascinating issue. Do unions have a role? And that's why I was curious if you were talking about unions or not. I think the best unions become partners in that value equation. They don't become, and they become obviously mirrors to hold up to make sure management's doing their job. But I hope they can become partners in building that relationship, the virtuous relationship between the employee and the customer.
Challenging by the very nature. But anyway, thanks a lot. That was a great answer. I really appreciate it. I think they have another question for you.
They do, actually. So Dwayne, they do, we do. So Dwayne Lay, who had the question that I asked about earlier, actually called in because you said you wish he had called in. So he's here. So Dwayne, go for
it. I'm having a hard time hearing whoever's speaking. It sounds like you're on a headset, so it's just hard to hear.
I just said that Dwayne Lay actually called in.
Okay.
So here he is. I think. Dwayne, go for it. Well.
Sorry, I just realized I had been muted that entire time. Sorry about that. Hi, everybody. How are you? Hi, Dave. Nice to talk to you. So I wanted to follow up on the question about the Kano model. I think that there were a couple
about
things
the
I
what model,
about
the
you.
What model?
I'm sorry, I'm getting interrupted.
I'm just not able to hear very well. The Kano model?
The Kano model. So for any...
Kano.
So just
I don't...
Yeah, so we're... Okay, so we're on the same page. The idea is, and it's a lean concept, there are some practices where it's valuable to be great at it, but if you can't be great, there's no value at all. There are some practices where you have to be good at it, but there's no value in being great, and, of course, the value being defined by your end customer. I thought it was interesting that you made the comment that the employees aren't, you didn't say they're not the end customer, but they're not your only end customer. I would be interested to hear if you think there's someone else who's more important for the HR function than the employee.
Yes.
And then,
yes.
That's because I agree that like the business customers are important as well, but from a service standpoint, I mean, that's our service group. Those are the people we're there to take care of. So I look at all of the HR functions, we define what our real value is based on that customer group. So I'm curious as to how you see other groups outside of them being more important than our immediate service group.
I think if we focus only on the employees, we don't have a balanced scorecard. We have a disproportionate scorecard. And I think HR's job, by the way, we've done an exercise where you say to the HR group, divide 100 points among employees, line managers inside the firm, customers, investors, and communities outside. Where a lot of HR people go, Dwayne, is where you go. 60, 70, 80% of HR should be on the employees and the line managers. Frankly, I think those are the HR folks that struggle to have full impact. Because their agenda is to make sure the employees are successful. What we have found in our research, and so this isn't just me speaking, the HR departments that have the most impact are 20-20-20-20, that we're focused across those five stakeholders. And the concept is balanced scorecard. But if you put 70 or 80% of your attention on the employee and you don't pay attention to the outside customer, you may be building employees who have a set of expectations that are not what the customer needs. A simple example on leadership. A lot of leadership competencies are created by saying, who have been our historically good or bad leaders? What's made a difference? We love to start leadership with the customer. What's the promise we've made a customer in our brand, in our firm, in our expectations? Does our leadership 360 model represent those promises? Otherwise, what we're doing is training leaders to do A, B, and C, and yet our customers are promised D, E, and F. And so... And again, I'm not going 80% outside. The research that we've done and published over the last 15 years is 20-20-20-20. Good HR people manage this inherent set of stakeholders. And so when you say the customer of HR is the employee, true and incomplete. And the reason I emphasize customers is most HR people, real customers of the firm, most HR people aren't there. They'll see their primary and sometimes exclusive job is the guardian of the employee. I would argue pretty strongly that that's too simplistic, that the world requires that we manage both. It's anyway, I'll stop with that. So, and we, by the way, we don't have to agree on that. There are a lot of folks who disagree with me who are much brighter than I am. So, but that's, I think that's where HR really creates the powerful value, is getting those multiple stakeholders aligned around common agendas.
So I think there's absolutely value in looking at the externals. When I've done design work, that's a big piece of it, is looking at the external stakeholders, who are the people that are impacted by the decisions. What I'm looking at is, I'll give you an example. When I'm looking at a payroll process, like we're paying the employees. They're the primary beneficiaries of that process. So, and this was all kind of hinged off of, you're talking about functional excellence. And this is kind of where it piqued my interest. So for example, like a payroll process is one that I look at and say, there's a limit to the value you get in trying to pursue quote-unquote excellence for that. Like you want to pay on time, you want to pay accurately, you want to pay the different ways. But like going beyond that and trying to reach whatever you consider an excellence of payroll outside of we pay everybody on time correctly each time, every time, like there becomes a point where you're investing resources doing it, and that is one that I think the employee is your primary customer. And that's where I was kind of thinking, I'm like, boy, yeah, there's some things that functional excellence is like critically important. Other ones where you've just got to be able to do the job, and the effort to go beyond that, there's not a lot of return based on the limited resources we usually have in HR to apply.
So let's take payroll. Take payroll. Payroll doesn't begin with payroll. It begins with criteria for payroll, unless you're just into managing the system. But payroll begins not with compensation. Payroll begins with standards. What are you paid for? I think good HR people have to understand that the standards by which you judge compensation should be tied to the promises you make customers and investors. And if you're only building a payroll system or a set of standards based on what employees want, you're going to build a system that's very dysfunctional. I mean, you may pay employees really well, and the company goes broke. That again, that's for me, that's where HR needs to go to really create value. Because if we just go in and say, I want to build an efficient payroll system, we're missing the backdrop of that payroll system. A payroll system is in place so the employees focus their attention on the right things. The standards that we set that drive the payroll system should not just be getting employees to be delighted and happy. They should be getting employees to better serve their external customers so that the company exists, and to provide economic success so that the investors are continually willing to invest. And so the standards that you set that drive payroll should be derived through an outside-in mentality. That's a great case study. It's a great case study of the limits of HR by focusing only on the employee.
Yeah, I think that I think it's more of a macro approach as opposed to like the actual like the functional process design piece that I'm used to working with. But it's interesting, and yeah, I appreciate your. I'll step back because I know other people have questions. But interesting discussion. Thanks very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Dwayne, for joining with us and asking your questions to Dave. Dave, we have one more question that has come up on our Twitter stream, and that is Ulas from India, and he is asking, should HR policies be primarily driven by the outside-in approach?
Should what? I'm sorry.
Should HR policies be primarily driven by the outside-in approach?
I don't know what that means. For example, one of the things we believe, and let me try to answer it. The outside in is, I call it a podcast. It's a perspective. It's the P of the podcast. And it's, are we in HR thinking outside in? I love that interaction with Dwayne. Because if somebody in HR comes in and says, boy, the only person I'm trying to serve is the employee, I am going to take, and again, don't have to agree. I think we serve the employee best by serving the customer, because that keeps the firm alive. The second thing HR does in my POD of HR is the outcome. And we think there's three outcomes of HR. One outcome is talent. That's great people. And HR is about employees, and it's about building people that are successful. And in the last 15 years, the HR field has been really focused on employees and talent. McKinsey did a great study with Ed Michaels and his colleagues called the War for Talent, and people have picked up on it. But I think there's two other outcomes HR should be focused on. One of those outcomes is organization, culture, systems, processes. In fact, I believe if you had a choice, the system or the culture is probably as valuable, if not more so, than the employee. In sports, the leading scorer is almost never on the team that wins the championship. The championship is usually won by teams. And I think in HR, we should be responsible for both talent and organization. And the intersection of those two for me is leadership. So when I often go into an HR group, I say there's three things that we provide outcomes in: talent, leadership, and culture. Our perspective should be from the outside in. Are we hiring the talent that will serve our customers, investors, and communities well? Are we building a culture that is not just about who we are, our identity, but our internal culture that reflects our firm brand in the marketplace? Are we building leadership, not the skills that we think leaders should have, but the skills that will give our customers, investors, and communities the light? Now, to his question in India, in each of those three areas, talent, leadership, and organization or culture, we have to set policy. And the policy should reflect the bridge between the outside and the inside. We also have to create processes, and they should build the bridge, and then we have to implement practices. So for each of those three areas, talent, leadership, and culture, we have policies, processes, and practices that will bridge the inside to the outside.
Okay. Hey, Dave, this is Mike Vandervoort again. That word culture means so many different things. What's your definition of culture, and what,
you know,
what are
I
the
love
things?
The question, Mike, and thank you so much. I love to ask people the question, what does culture mean? And here's the answers we usually get: values, unwritten rules, norms, expectations. Most of the definitions of culture, well, there seem to be three phases of culture. One phase of culture seems to be the symbols and the artifacts of a company. So you go into a company and you see the way the office is laid out. You see the stories and the symbols. A second definition of culture is the patternation of work, which are values, norms, expectations. And there's folks who do a great job studying that. There's some very nice work by Dan Dennison out of IMD around managing and understanding culture. In The Rise of HR, there's some this book, there's some wonderful essays. In fact, one of the sections on the future of HR is looking at how we define and use this concept of culture. I define culture, and we define culture a little different. We believe culture is the identity of the firm in the mind of your critical customers, made real to your employees. And so it's the outside-in approach. In order to get culture, it's not just do you have a culture, do you have the right culture? What do we want to be known for by customers? Back to the earlier comments about airlines. If you fly a lot on an airline, and it sounds like Crystal flies a lot on American, what does she, a critical customer, want American to be known for? That identity in her mind will cause her to fly American more often. And that's the value of the culture, is that it causes customers to choose the airline when they have a choice. We want share of customer. I love to take that external firm brand or identity and then turn it into a set of internal practices. And for me, culture is the identity of the firm in the mind of your key customers, made real to all of your employees. Again, notice it's an outside-in approach that manages the paradox between the outside and the inside. And let me tell you why I love that. When we go to a company and we say, do you have a set of values? Absolutely. 90% of companies have a set of values. Take them outside to your customers. Ask three questions. Number one, are these the values you, the customer, want us to have? Generally, yes. Sometimes, no. I was in a firm once, and they said, our number one value is to be the most profitable firm in our industry. And I said, let me be honest, most of your customers won't be excited about that because that means you're going to make money at their expense. Question one, are these the values you want us to have? Question two, could you tell us what those values mean? So instead of the employees defining and operationalizing the values, let the customers. My example of that is pretty simple. I fly quite a bit. I tend to like to carry my suitcase from my cab to my hotel room. I don't define service as them doing that. And yet many people define service because that's what service is to them. They pick up my suitcase and carry it. Let the customer define the value. And number three, when we do those things that you say are valuable to you, will you buy more products from us? Now, when I work with business leaders about culture, I say culture is the identity of the firm in the mind of the customer. You have a set of values. Are they real to the customer, and will they cause an increase in customer share? And then the business leader finally says, I got it. Culture is not just a social agenda. It's also an economic agenda. Anyway, longer answer than you wanted, but that's how we approach it.
See, that's a very interesting approach, and this is Crystal. I'm going to hop in here. So this is an area that I work in quite frequently, and I have to say there's culture as a marketing piece, and then there's cultural reality. So to say, hey, our customers are going to be the ones to define our culture is all well and good, except it doesn't functionally work that way. I mean, you can't just tell your employees the customers don't see this as being a value or something that needs to be part of our cultural reality, therefore your experiences and beliefs now don't matter. Like that.
Well, there's four levels of customer interface. Actually, it does a lot. I mean, there's four levels of interface with customers. One is pure transaction. You know, we'll sell our product over the internet. You put out a book, we'll buy the book. A second is service. We'll give you good service to do the transactions. A third is partnership with customers. And a fourth is anticipation. What we find is the higher up that customer value chain you go with your targeted customers, the more that you're going to get value from them because they're going to give you more of their revenue. When you think of culture from the outside in, the customer doesn't define the culture because we do branding. The customer doesn't define our brand. We do a brand, but we create a brand so that we can anticipate what the customer wants from us. In the airline, what is it you want as a frequent traveler that will really make us a value to you? And in HR, if we start culture with that criterion, then we're building the right culture. We're not just building – sometimes we can get a unified culture, but it's not the culture that's going to make a difference with the marketplace. And I love to start culture from the economic because I think you can begin to work across those boundaries.
Okay. I wish we had another hour with you because that's fascinating, and I think it would be a very
Absolutely.
Lively discussion. So hopefully you'll come back on and we can chat about that again sometime. Thank you so much for joining us today. For anyone who is joining in now, we had Dave Ulrich on today. You should absolutely listen to the download. You can talk to him on Twitter at Dave, D-A-V-E, underscore Ulrich, U-L-R-I-C-H. And you should, because he's got some really interesting things to say, and I think we could all learn from it. So thank you again for joining us. From everyone at Drive-Thru HR, Michael, William, Nisha, and myself, we really appreciate your time, Dave.
Have a great day.
You too.